Welcome to the Docs Who Lift podcast, where we distill and simplify the complexities of a healthy lifestyle, exercise, medicine, and weight loss. We're excited to bring you a podcast that's a prescription for clinical practice, scientific recommendations, and just real life. This is the Docs Who Lift podcast.
Oh, yeah. Welcome back to the Docs Who Lift podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Spencer Nadolski. Co-host, Dr. Carl Nadolski, super endocrinologist. And this week, we're going to be talking about the brand new conference that just is going on, actually, as we speak. I don't know if it just ended or not.
No, it's still going on through today at the European Association for the Study of Diabetes, a big global conference for, especially for endocrinologists, but anybody who works with obesity and diabetes. It's sort of the counterpart to the American Diabetes Association, but for Europe to some degree, but they work a lot together.
Yeah. A lot of the big trials that come out, they get reported at various conferences through the year. The next big one that we're going to see is probably next month, where we see the American Heart Association. They're going to be presenting the SELECT trial that we've been waiting for. But this one had a few little nuggets in there. They presented the SURMOUNT-4 data. SURMOUNT-4 was a study looking at tirzepatide, my favorite current drug, if we can have a favorite current
drug.
Seems
like everyone's current favorite drug.
I don't make any money from Eli Lilly. Not yet.
Not yet.
As I usually say. No, I don't make any money from it. It's just this drug is amazing. We've talked about it many times. GLP-1/GIP co-agonist, receptor agonist medicine. Robust, amazing weight loss findings. The thing about this one was interesting. I don't know if you have the little slides or anything pulled up, but the SURMOUNT-4 is basically they put everybody on this drug, and after some time they titrated, they stopped some people, they switched them to some people to a placebo. Yeah. And what's interesting though about this is before we start getting into that, they were on the drug for a total of, I believe, 88 weeks. You can confirm at the data.
They did a 36-week, what they call open label, for almost 800 people.
So everybody's on it.
With obesity and an average mass of 107 kilograms.
So the cool thing about this is that we see an extended period of time. So if anybody remembers SURMOUNT-1, that was the first big trial that came out last year that looked at basically tirzepatide versus placebo in those with obesity. That was 72 weeks. And you can correct me if I'm wrong there, but I believe I'm correct. 72 weeks. So this one, the people that were continued on the drug, 88 weeks. And if you look at the average weight loss of the two, for those were SURMOUNT-1, where they were only on at 72 weeks, what was it, around 21% or so weight loss? Mm-hmm. Somewhere around there. This one, though, when they continued to 88 weeks, it was more like 25, 20, almost 26% weight loss. Is that right?
Well, so if you go back, so the 36-week run-in in phase, it was followed by that randomized to placebo or continued
on. So some people were randomized for 36 weeks to a placebo. They wanted to see basically what happens when you start taking people off the drug versus those if you continue the drug.
And so for randomized participants, that's where the mean body weight was 237 pounds or 107 kilograms. At the end of the 36-week tirzepatide lead-in period, they already achieved a 21% mean weight loss.
36 weeks, that's pretty amazing.
I don't know how
that's possible.
You know, and this is what, and again, this study, it's been presented now, but it's not simultaneously published. So this is, I would think this is being published as we speak, but I have not seen the actual publication. A lot of these trials that are presented at these big meetings are simultaneously published. A few other ones we'll talk about have been. This one specifically is not. So we're still kind of going based upon some
slides
of the raw data.
We're seeing some slides on Twitter that some of our buddies, I would say maybe not our buddies, but our tweeter buddies, are over there watching these trials. When we see the slides that they're putting up there. But I think, you know, top line results of it are pretty interesting because, in fact, when you look at who responds, because that's the other thing, the responder data, right, where they look at the categorical weight loss of 5, 10, 15, 20%, it looks like very few, once you're on this drug for a long period of time, very few don't respond to it. And that's what I'm seeing. With semaglutide, it's more like, it's if you're looking at 5%, it's like a 5 to 10%. If you're looking at 10%, it starts dropping down to like whatever, 25% of people don't respond or so, if you look at 10% threshold. But for tirzepatide, most people,
it's like really almost everyone's responding if we're using those low thresholds.
Yeah.
And that's why, you know, all these new medications come down the pipeline, the standard is being elevated.
Yeah. Before we had these drugs, we had a contrave with bupropion naltrexone. We had just liraglutide, Saxenda, and we had something called Qsymia. We've talked about these drugs, but those are kind of the older generation one anti-obesity medicines. And so they looked at 5% before, but now it's just like, well, we better pump these numbers up. Those are rookie numbers. We got to get up to 10%. That's where you see even more clinical weight loss. I mean, 5% is still good, but 10%, they're like,
yeah,
well, we might as well.
It's meaningful. But yeah, these are really important for people who have very severe complications of obesity, because it's when we start getting over 10, 15 and more percent weight reduction where we see literal, you know, resolution or remission of a lot of these complications. And that ranges from, you know, type 2 diabetes, at least the hyperglycemia, to their lipids, the blood pressure, sleep apnea, and certainly the cardiovascular risk reduction that we hope
fatty
to,
liver, I think, is where you know, 10, liver, well,
especially
10 absolutely. To 15.
And that's,
you really got to get
and
that.
We're talking about, you know, this gets a little complicated, I know, but not just the fatty liver aspect to it, but reducing the risk of fibrosis, which is what we actually care about with fatty liver. So, you know, real liver disease, ultimately. Well, anyway, so, you know, we talked about that lead-in period already getting a lot of good weight reduction. But then the nice thing about it is that as you go down the rest of the year, so they went another 52 weeks, and ultimately there was about a 26% on average, mind you, weight reduction for those who remained on the tirzepatide. And then there was still about a 10% weight reduction at the end of that for those who had initially lost you know, the weight and then were randomized to placebo. But that obviously entails some weight regain that we see with all these medications when we stop treating the underlying pathophysiology that's driving the obesity.
So a few things. When I usually say with tirzepatide, you can expect to see 21% or so weight loss, and that's over the course of 72 weeks. I don't know if I should just start saying, like, if you stay on tirzepatide, you're going to see an average of more like a quarter, you know, like a 25. It just really depends on the length of time. And also, you know, step one, semaglutide, that one's actually shorter than 72 weeks. What is it? 64? I don't know. I can never
68.
I can't remember. 68. Yeah, 68. Okay. So it's a little bit shorter. So I don't know if they would continue. It might not. So that might be important to note.
Well, and also it's important because we're going to talk about some of the other trials with tirzepatide and type 2 diabetes. So SURMOUNT-4 was obesity without type 2 diabetes, and it's been studied and already approved with a lot of data for type 2 diabetes, and weight reduction is less. It's in all type 2 diabetes trials. So when you have obesity complicated by type 2 diabetes, every single weight loss trial, like ever, has a lower overall weight reduction on average than those without type 2 diabetes, even including metabolic syndrome, insulin resistance type pre-diabetes. So just to be fair, so when you talk about, you know, kind of this average weight reduction and what to expect, people who have obesity
without
type 2
diabetes,
it's not as much, but it's still very, very meaningful. And
that was,
you know,
that was what was confusing about SURMOUNT-2. I think we talked about this a few months ago, but when SURMOUNT-2 data came out, people were like, what? I thought this drug got 21%, but it was more around 15% total body weight loss for those
it
with
was
type 2 diabetes.
Which is funny because obviously all the trials for tirzepatide, branded as Mounjaro, with the exact same dosing and basically the very similar types of trial data for type 2 diabetes had already been published and made it get to approval. You know, it's very similar to that, obviously, because it was for obesity with type 2 diabetes. Just
right,
like
and the
type 2
step,
diabetes trials.
Yeah, and step 2 trial, which was semaglutide in those with type 2 diabetes, it didn't reach the 15%. It was more like, what, around 11 or it was like
11%. It was the same as, you know, of the Ozempic trials.
Yeah,
and Ozempic and Wegovy are the same thing, and the media keeps trying to play that game. Although I'll tell you what, that does lead us to. This was a really cool. This is one study that I shared this week because it just happened to get presented and published at the same time as I had a patient who had a very similar story as what this trial was. So the SURPASS 6 trial was with tirzepatide. And again, SURPASS is for the type 2 diabetes indication and primary outcomes, whereas SURMOUNT's for the obesity and weight reduction. So SURPASS 6 was when they randomized people who were already on basal insulin for their type 2 diabetes. So basal insulin is like the fasting insulin. Anybody who has diabetes probably knows what I'm talking about. And so they were on an average of, I think it was 46 units of insulin going in, or 42 units going into that trial. Okay. And their average A1C was almost 9%. So that means, you know, their average sugars, their sugars are not good. They're up around, you know, 200 on average at that point. And so they randomized people to tirzepatide or to bolus insulin. So one of the short acting insulins we use, especially in type 1 diabetes.
Mealtime.
Yeah, for mealtime insulin called Lispro. And they started with 4 units per meal, and then twice a week for the first half of the trial, they titrated it up to their goals, and then once a week in the second half. And by the way, so all these different places where they do the trials, they are given target sugar goals to titrate the insulin, both the basal and the bolus. And so as you can imagine, to try to get to these are pretty tight goals, by the way. They had goals of 100 to 125 milligrams per deciliter, which is more aggressive than most of us will ever use for type 2 diabetes on insulin, mind you. And ultimately, as you can imagine, the group that was randomized to the insulin ended up with more insulin, over 100 units a day total between basal and bolus. And they had an A1C reduction of 1.1%. And of course they gained like 3% of their weight, right? The group, on average, so they had the different doses of tirzepatide or Mounjaro, they went down over 2% in their A1C. So it was even better A1C reduction. They didn't have really any hypoglycemia, while the group that got insulin had over 4% of the time getting at least level 2 hypoglycemia, low sugars, and that's under 54 milligrams per deciliter. So that's, you know, pushing pretty dangerous stuff. And they averaged about a 10-pound weight reduction. And a fair number of them, not only did they not have to add bolus mealtime insulin,
off of it.
They had dramatic reductions in their basal insulin, as we always expect. And this is what we love to do. And a fair number of them were able to get off all insulin altogether.
So this is what makes the practice of medicine very interesting, and technology makes things a lot easier for not only patients, but also clinicians, because you can imagine trying to make sure that a patient doesn't go hypoglycemic by adjusting their insulin with mealtime shots and then basal shots titrating up and down. Now you give them something that helps them lose weight, feel better, get them off more insulin, and just overall improvements and no hypoglycemia or fewer hypoglycemic events, I assume.
And it absolutely was. And so then I just to give a shout out to my patient, I don't know if she listens to this, but who saw me in clinic the other day. She came to us in the spring, ironically on around about like 46 units of basal insulin and metformin, and her A1C was almost 10% at that time, and she was just struggling with her nutrition and exercise. We put her on tirzepatide along with nutrition and exercise regimen, dramatically reduced her basal insulin at that moment, gave her a little plan to go off of it. She's been off of her insulin for a couple of months. She's lost 15% of her weight over the summer. She's exceedingly happy. She's walking around, and her A1C is 5.5%.
Yeah.
I mean, remarkable. Zero insulin.
We don't own stock in Lilly. I just want to make sure everybody knows we don't own stock in Lilly. We don't make money. But, man, they made a tremendous drug here.
We should.
Apparently, we're doing their marketing. They should be giving us money. We're free marketing for them.
I know. Jeez, someday.
Yeah,
maybe they can sponsor the podcast. They can do a commercial during the podcast. But anyway, so that's pretty awesome.
That is pretty cool.
And we have data to back it up. We have anecdotal evidence. We have our patients doing it, getting off insulin, just doing better with their lives. It's awesome.
Yeah. Next thing, or for
well, wait,
the prime.
Do you want to talk about the MRI studies?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Go through the MRI stuff.
Because there's been a lot of concern raised about the muscle mass loss. We've had a couple different podcasts on this. If you look up some of the body composition discussions we've had, the concern that Peter Attia, we have to mention him every once in a while.
Every time.
He scaremongers everyone.
Hey.
Yeah, God. Anyways, you know, he got everyone scared about the muscle mass loss with semaglutide and these new medications that are helping people lose so much weight. We got to be careful
Joe
about Rogan's the muscle
mass
loss.
Saying it because he said Peter Attia did a study. There was no study. There was not a study. It was an anecdote. Attia. I don't know if
he doesn't do any studies.
No, there was no study.
So the people actually doing the studies looked at this with the tirzepatide. So they actually did a sub-analysis. There were a couple posters presented at the EASD for this. They used MRI
MRI, and if you
muscle.
Listen back to our buddy Grant Tinsley, who is a body composition expert, when you look at just lean mass loss, it could be fluid change. We don't know. It's not guaranteed to be muscle. So you actually have to look at muscle changes. And so this MRI does a little bit better.
Yeah. So this was a sub-analysis of actually the SURPASS-3. So again, that's with
diabetes,
Diabetes study. It was compared to a basal insulin actually in that study. And basically what they found was that there was no concern in the muscle composition, but importantly, there was a dramatic reduction in intramuscular fat. And that's part of the pathophysiology of diabetes, insulin resistance, inflammation, all that stuff. So there was reduction in intramuscular fat with the tirzepatide that correlated with the weight reduction, improved lipids, and improved blood pressure. And with the other arm, that was a basal insulin, like I said, they compared it to, there was increased intramuscular fat.
Yeah, as you lose fat, you're going to lose it from all the different places and the places it's not supposed to be and the places you want it to be, you know, from your subcutaneous fat that's around places that you don't like for vanity purposes. But we care about, you know, what's on the inside, which is also the fat around your organs, the fat into your organs and the fat in your muscles, because that can cause insulin resistance. Your insulin won't work as well.
Lift some weights. Everyone needs to do resistance training. We're the docs who lift. That's what we really shill out.
Yeah,
so we
exactly
keep that muscle mass, regardless of what we're doing. So
we don't make any money from Rogue or whatever the fitness place.
Although those would probably be good sponsors too. We should probably make a list.
Come on, Rogue. give me a belt squat. Okay, or Orforglipron.
Yeah, so this is I think we talked about this because they started presenting it at the ADA conference.
A couple months ago.
So they presented a couple of the trials here. Some of these are actually repeat trials, but they had one trial presented for type 2 diabetes, and then one trial presented for obesity without diabetes. And this is a non-peptide oral by mouth GLP-1 receptor agonist.
So they call it small molecule. So the reason they use these peptides usually, and you can't take them orally because your stomach acid will break it up. That's why with Rybelsus, which is
basically oral
semaglutide, they put a special little thing around it to help it get absorbed by your stomach. But it's really hard. It's really difficult because you can't drink much with it. You can't eat around it. It'll ruin the whole absorption system. Pretty cool technology. But these new things are new molecules that actually hit the receptors without actually being a peptide that would get broken up in your stomach. So you can take it orally. This one is specifically made by Eli Lilly. Again, we're not making money.
Oh, my
money
God. We should be making money from Eli Lilly.
I know.
Come
we
on.
Should. We're, like, Jeez. What are we? This is... How many people listen to this?
And this is the one when I first shared it, I had a picture of the Swedish chef because I feel like it's something he would say.
Orforglipron. It does. It's Orforglipron. It's ridiculous name. Who knows what the actual trade name is going to be. But this one gets around 15% weight loss, right?
Yeah. So in the trial without diabetes, they had, and these are still phase 2 trials, by the way, but you know, they had almost 300 patients. Again, they had about a kilogram mass of about 109, BMI of 38. And, in the first 26 weeks, in the different doses, they had almost 12.5% weight reduction. And then by the 36-week mark, they were at about 10% and 15% weight reduction compared to just 2% with placebo, which is, if you've listened to any of our discussions on these trials, that's pretty typical for a lifestyle placebo arm without the intensive behavioral modification. So that's Yeah, I mean, that's very meaningful.
Yeah, so this is going to be a few years before it's even out. They got to do the phase three, and then it takes time for it to get approved. But think of this being out, maybe it's about to be 2024, maybe 2026 at the earliest, I would probably say.
Interesting,
these drugs, everybody's like the shortages, everything. These drugs are easily, much more readily manufactured because it's not this peptide and you have to put into these special pens that you have to inject. It's, these would be little pills that they could make in their little, I don't know. I've never, I'm not at a factory making these things.
Yeah.
But this is what I'm told.
Not at all. You're far from a pharmacist, pharmacotherapeutic.
No, we do very little manual labor.
We're very clinical. Maybe we can. So anyways, and then they had another, you know, they presented the other 26-week phase two trial for people with type 2 diabetes. That almost 400 patients. They had really good A1C reduction ranging from like 1 to 2% with 0.4% in the placebo arm, certainly superior for glycemic reduction. And they had pretty good weight reduction in that one also.
I do want to jump back to the SURMOUNT-4 real quick. So, because this is my big thing. I'm watching these patients. We got to publish our data, but a lot of people will require lifelong therapy. I don't know the number. There's probably phenotypical, genotypical differences. I don't even know yet. I have some ideas, but what you'll see is on average, most people will start regaining their weight and they'll regain probably most of their weight back, whether this is 60% or 75% of their average weight. It's hard to know. However, there will be some people that can actually come off the medicine. And I do think it's different between whether they stop abruptly, where you see these reports of people going, yeah, it was helped with my food noise and binge eating, and I stopped abruptly and my binge eating got worse than what it was before. And you can imagine if you stopped abruptly, you're first, when you start the medicine, right before you start the medicine, you have this amount of hunger. As you lose weight, our bodies ramp up our hunger. But if you have a medicine blocking that hunger, if you stop it abruptly, you're actually going to have all those newer biological forces coming on top of your old biological forces, which could potentially make things worse. So I do think there's something to weaning somebody down versus stopping abruptly. I will also say that
now you're making some extrapolative hypothesis generating stuff.
I'm saying I think this is just
totally this is what I'm seeing outside the box,
and I'm, you know, what I'm seeing. Yeah,
just
what I'm
for people around, to be clear.
Yeah, what I'm messing around clinically, and I'm seeing certain things. Again, this is why we do need to do randomized controlled trials because, like, you know, what I see, I have all sorts of biases and whatever. This is why you can't just go, "Oh, this is what I do clinically," and this is what's the truth. I'm just seeing it. That's what I'm guessing. I also think there are some people that can. The initial weight loss is different than the weight maintenance. When you lose, we talk about the pathophysiology and the neurobiology of obesity and the inflammatory and dysregulation of appetite that's going on and the hypothalamus and the reward pathways, whatever. So they may need a bigger gun to help with the initial weight loss and may need a smaller gun, such as one of these non-GLP-1 medicines. Yeah. So what I'm doing is putting people on, and this isn't, not because the patient wanted to, because their insurance says we're not covering this anymore.
Right.
I got
to
go.
Sometimes
oh my God.
We're forced to do stuff
Forced. I'm not doing this because I'm like, let's just try this out. And the patient wants to try it. They're forced to. So they're really worried. Yeah. Their appetite does come back. I go, let's try a little bit of bupropion, naltrexone, and sometimes metformin on top of it. Sometimes it's not enough. Other patients go,
I know you. You can't do that, but we do a lot of phenamine, topiramate.
Yes. So if I could,
once these people
I would,
come up.
And this is a whole nother discussion because I'm trying to figure out how maybe we could do that in the future. I don't know.
We have ideas for people.
Republic company, but whatever. Anyway, yeah. So ideas. Phentermine, topiramate probably are the most powerful things, the combination Qsymia. But I use naltrexone, bupropion, and metformin. And we're seeing a lot of people, it holds that food noise and appetite at bay, whereas it wouldn't have helped them lose the weight in the first place, but it's helping them maintain the weight loss.
Yeah.
Anyway.
We're seeing that too.
I
will say going back to one of a recent patient anecdotes, for the same reason, the person was able to get tirzepatide, for the coupon over the year, had very good weight reduction and is doing very well with her nutrition exercise efforts over the summer off of it since she's had to go off. Her weight is maintaining. She has the subjective, meaning her feelings, her symptoms of, you know, she can tell there's the hunger and a little bit more of the food noise. And so, but she's not on anything right now. And she's she's maintaining. We might have to do something like phenamine, topiramate, all these other things.
Yeah.
But, you know, she's doing all the things that we already know have the evidence behind, you know, weight maintenance from the, like the weight maintenance registry trial and all that stuff. I mean, she's putting in the good effort and she is maintaining, but everyone's different.
Yeah.
You know, everyone's genetic.
We don't know.
Pathophysiology is so different.
You don't know until you're going to try.
Yep.
And hopefully you don't have to try because your insurance is good, but you never know.
Well,
you gotta, yeah. That's a whole nother discussion. Okay.
Yeah.
Lastly, a report came out of the JAMA. This is a research letter. And of course the news media outlets loved it. Because they love fear-mongering these GLP-1 medicines. There have been some reports, and now there's a black box warning about small bowel obstruction in those taking, I think it's, is it like, black box warning on both Ozempic and Wegovy?
Yeah,
I don't know.
What, semaglutide.
They added on semaglutide.
So it's rare, if it's
never
even real.
Never seen in the trials.
Huge trials, mind you.
And how have they been... How are they diagnosed? There's so many different questions I have. So there are a couple people that seem to have come forward that had serious ones, and then maybe a few more that had less serious bowel obstruction. And when they say bowel obstruction, usually there's something actually obstructing the bowel. Like after surgery, we see adhesions where you do abdominal surgery, the bowel starts sticking to itself, and so that it obstructs the food going through your intestines. But there's other things called Bezoars. You eat a high amount of whatever. Some people eat hair, all sorts of things, and it can actually clog up your intestines. And then there's something called non-obstructive, which is like an ileus, where we see post-op, where your bowels aren't working. They're just sitting there and not actually having any motility. These drugs do slow down gastric emptying, and there may be some motility changes, but it's not permanent. It wanes over time. It actually improves, maybe doesn't go back to normal, but it generally improves. So what these people are saying is that there's somebody was having true, I don't know if it was actual obstructive or ileus, like what we see post-op, but there were a couple reports of it. We've never seen it in the trials. We've never seen it clinically. I've never seen it clinically. We have tens of thousands of patients at our, online program at, Weight Watchers, but, something to look out for. It's a black box warning. I think it has to be very rare. Now, this research letter, though, to get back to that, this group did a chart, basically, analysis of 16 million charts and looked at who was on liraglutide, and semaglutide, and also those on bupropion and naltrexone. And what they wanted to compare, they used naltrexone and bupropion or Contrave as the reference group. And they wanted to compare it to those taking liraglutide or semaglutide and see any hazards, any safety issues popping up. They looked at specifically biliary complications, pancreatitis, gastroparesis. Am I missing anything else?
Or is the big ones? Bowel obstruction.
Did they look at bowel obstruction? Okay.
Yeah.
So here's the deal. So of course this is making media headlines. I made a video about it. If you look closely at the methods, the issue is, first of all, in the introduction, they say like, well, we can't rely on the RCTs. They're too small and too short. And I'm like, well, they're not too small, I don't think. Because when you look at the sample size of what they pulled out, it's actually smaller than what you see in the trials.
The reason they say that is because these side effects are so exceedingly rare, you have to have millions and millions of people to even come close to it. But like you just said, this cohort that they pulled out of all those millions of charts.
16 million. It wasn't actually 16 million people on these medicines.
It only had 4,000 people with liraglutide, 600 with semaglutide, and 650 with
smaller,
the bupropion.
Smaller than
bupropion
what we've seen. The only one that was bigger was the liraglutide. But in the scale trial, we saw there were 2,200 on the active drug, and I can't remember on placebo. Scale was pretty big. And we have meta-analyses of these drugs, too, where they pile in all these people and put together all the trial data.
And in those meta-analyses, mind you, the gallbladder disease, the biliary disease, which wasn't even really increased in this research letter that we're talking about, was the only thing.
That's the only thing that,
was
see.
That was, and it was like in the 1.5 to 1% range in the meta-analyses, and something like pancreatitis, which we are very concerned about. Historically with these meds has not been shown to be increased in those meta-analyses of these, so
we see it anecdotally, but I think it's from gallstone, mostly gallstone pancreatitis. Well, you lose weight quickly. You create gallstones, the gallstone gets in the wrong duct, causes pancreatitis. So what they found an increased risk of pancreatitis, right? And
and these are very small absolute numbers. It's just all relatively statistical numbers. So for example, like for the biliary disease, for example, it was 11.7 per 1,000 person years for semaglutide, and this is where it wasn't even increased because it was 12.5. Per 1,000 person years for the bupropion naltrexone, but then it was 4.5, 7.9, and 1 respectively for pancreatitis for the sema, lira, and bupropion.
But here's
naltrexone. That's small numbers.
But here's the kicker: who cares about like the statistics? Okay, interesting. Here's the kicker, though: the way that they look at how this was done, they looked at ICD-9 and ICD-10 codes for what people, clinicians, could be a doctor, nurse practitioner, PA. Physician assistant. It looks at what diagnosis they put in the chart. And what they also added for gastroparesis, if they were put on a promotility drug. So anybody listening to this, I'm sure there's at least one person that's listening to this that has taken a promotility drug for intractable nausea and vomiting due to a GLP-1 agonist. These drugs are known. This is the most common side effect, nausea. And if nausea gets so bad, it's vomiting. Some doctors put people on promotility drugs. This is a metoclopramide or Reglan, the same. It's the trade name for it. So if someone put them on this drug, they counted that as a case of gastroparesis. That's not how you diagnose gastroparesis. Not right. only that, is you don't. The reason the RCTs are so important is because they actually look into the true diagnoses. They actually want to confirm this was an actual case of XYZ, pancreatitis, gastroparesis, anything else, gallstones, whatever. Doctors, unfortunately, we're not perfect, and we have the ways we do our practice. Some doctors may put in a diagnosis of whatever, pancreatitis, when it's just on the differential. And also, these drugs increase lipase levels. This has been known since the beginning. And this is why you don't just automatically measure lipase levels.
Yeah.
So what I imagine, somebody goes into the ER having some nausea and vomiting. They get a lipase level
and this happens all the time in real life.
So yes,
well, not
course,
dog in the ER.
If you're, yeah, if, no, we're not dog. It's no, but you see it. So then they get an elevated lipase level. I don't know if it's the ER that puts it on the chart, but they go back to see their primary care doctor. Goes, I guess you had a little pancreatitis because your lipase was elevated and you had a little nausea, vomiting. That's not how you diagnose pancreatitis. But in this paper, that would have counted as a case. So I basically had to make a video to discuss this. Who cares about the statistics? There's somebody on Twitter right now like arguing, are you mad about the statistics? I'm not mad about the statistics. It's the methods of how they actually counted a case versus not. And so the reason I brought up the SELECT trial in the beginning of this is because the SELECT trial has something like 17 or some thousand people in the trial. It's 4 to 5 years. It's looking at semaglutide versus placebo, and it's used for cardiovascular disease event reduction. However, I think just as cool as the primary outcomes, I think we're going to see more of those safety signals that we're concerned about to make sure that we feel better about it. Because if it's possible, I will eat crow. I will eat crow if it shows like, oh gosh, yeah, there is a signal for pancreatitis. We'll see it.
But you know what though? Even if that's the case, we already know it's a very low risk. Even if it is a true risk, this still goes back to people who only really have the indication for getting this therapy.
Risks and benefits, my friends.
We should not be on them. People in Hollywood, people who just want a little bit of cosmetic weight loss, that's not what these are for.
No.
These are for people with real obesity, and the more severe the disease based upon their complications, especially type 2 diabetes, are the ones who have the indication and get the most benefit, so that the benefit far outweighs any of the potential risks. And then the side effects, which are very statistically real, you know, like there is a lot of nausea and sometimes vomiting or other things like constipation. And so you have to weigh those things. Yeah.
So
and,
imagine, you know, if the, let's say there is a risk of this ileus and it can be permanent, or gastroparesis, or if, and for some reason it's one in a million. Let's say it's one in a million. We may not even see it on the trial then, but let's say it's rare, but it could potentially happen.
Telling me there's a chance.
There's a chance. Let's say it is, and you took it for vanity weight loss. That I would be mortified as a doctor if I prescribed this medicine for vanity weight loss and somebody got that. I would be mortified. I'd feel, and this is why it's unethical. It's not good medicine.
Yeah.
Stop doing that. And same with
these BS compounded versions of these. Oh, who knows what the heck those things are?
I wouldn't take it.
I would never let any of my loved ones take it. And I wouldn't give it to any of my patients because I care about them. Even if maybe they do have weight reduction, because we don't know what they are. We don't know their actual concentration, their dosing.
Where are they coming from?
Whose bathtub were they were made in? Good God.
Where are they coming from? Nobody knows. Although I do have some people will DM me like, oh, you should look at the chemical analyses. They're actually cleaner than the XYZ. I'm like, okay, I'll have to test it myself and whatever, I guess. But I wouldn't prescribe them.
Right. No, hell no.
I also found out that because people will be like, oh, you guys just want FDA approved because you are big pharma shills. We don't make any money from it for the 20th time on this podcast. And the funny thing is, we would make far more money. You know how much these compounders are making?
Oh, they're the ones making all the money. Follow the money.
They're making so much money.
And the compounders are the ones making the
money. They're making millions.
It's so ironic. We should do a whole podcast on that. Oh, my God.
They're going to send us a cease and each. We don't have to name names, but like.
Yeah, we will.
I also see influencers promoting these compounds. They get I've seen some of them make $10,000 to $20,000 per month by promoting these things. I'm like, oh, my God, this is a wild west right now.
Yeah, that's not good. We should take them down.
I know. I hope the Novo lawyers and the Eli Lilly lawyers, I'm sure they're pretty good because these are like some of the biggest companies in the world.
I don't know.
You never know.
All right.
Anyway, that's all we got for this week. That was a little bit longer. We wanted to go over some of these cool trial data. Obesity is a disease. We're going to go over, though, probably in the near future about how maybe not everybody with anthropometric obesity has the disease of obesity. It's not true clinic. Anyway, this is a whole thing. I think it's going to be something interesting we talk about.
We're going off the rails a little bit.
No, we always do. Anyway, thanks for listening. Share this with somebody who you think might benefit. Give us a little rating on whatever you're listening to, Spotify, Apple, Google, I don't know, whatever. Anyway, bye.
This podcast is for entertainment and education and information purposes only. Remember, the physicians on this podcast are not your physician. It should not be considered professional or personalized medical advice. It should not be used to replace speaking with your physician or medical professional to discuss your specific health concerns. The topics discussed should not be used solely to diagnose or treat any condition. As a result, we are not responsible for any unwanted medical outcomes. The views and opinions discussed are of those of the host only and do not represent those of any other entities. We'll be right back.